There was a quote by the theologian Paul Tillich many years ago where he said that he was inspired to some of his most creative work by a question that his son has asked him, and that question was, why is there something and not nothing? And there's a more biological question that stimulated me over the years, and it's sort of, why is there not something, and why isn't there not something else? In other words, there are always variations, and how can you explain those cases when there is a design which seems to be nearly universal? Why is that so? That's one question. The other is that many cases, the more often the case, where you find apparently alternative designs that look like they're doing the same things, can you understand that difference? Can you come up with some design principle that would allow you to rationalize those differences? So those are the questions that have stimulated me most over the years, probably. And particularly, I want to focus on questions of design and gene circuitry today. And if you ask, you know, what is the function of gene circuitry, you know, the typical answer would be something like, well, you know, in the genotype, you have the information encoded in the DNA sequence, and the phenotype is the context-dependent expression of that information in the genome. And the circuitry is there to interpret the context and orchestrate appropriate patterns of expression to meet the demands of the organism. But of course, as you look a little deeper, you find that in fact, as we've seen already in this conference, there are levels, hierarchical levels of regulation and control in these systems. And at each level, you see often a diversity of designs that seem to be doing similar things, and raises the question, are these differences in design accidents, that evolution is a sloppy process, it stumbles on these designs, they work, and it sort of sticks with them, or is there some rule that would, if you could discover it, would tell you why you have one design versus another? So the way we approach this over the years is on one hand, we've been interested in developing sort of mathematical tools that would allow us to represent these alternative biological systems or designs, even in cases where it's a hypothetical alternative. And then we would apply these to generic classes of systems. That is, we're not so much interested in looking at one particular system and modeling that in great detail, although we've done some of that. I'm more interested in looking at a large class of systems such that if you could discover some rule about that class, you'd have many instances to test that rule. So when I do want to test that, the organism I'm usually thinking about, having grown up in the microbiology department for some 30 years, I think of E. coli, a very robust organism, as we've heard many times already in this series. It's very versatile. There are something like an order of magnitude of 100 different carbon sources that this organism could use for its sole source of carbon and energy for growth. And yet, it doesn't carry around the machinery to utilize all of those carbon sources all the time. It's very efficient. It only induces them when it's appropriate, and it does this in a very rapid, responsive fashion. So those are all features that make this interesting. And of course, those features are important because it lives in different environments. It's in there in your colon, and it's also out there in the environment, lakes, streams, doorknobs, etc. And it has to cycle through these different environments as part of its normal life cycle. I'll give you one example of what I mean by a design principle that rationalizes a variation in design. It's an example we call demand theory, something we've worked on over the years. I'm not going to say a great deal about it. I just want to give you a flavor of how you can abstract out from many different systems a rule that seems to have a very great predictive value. And then I'll tell you a little bit about the methodology of how we want to do these comparisons to bring out these differences when you have systems that have a lot of accidental differences, if you like, that we want to make sure we exclude and focus on the essentials. And then I'll give you three examples of how we use this methodology to get at something about the coupling of elementary gene circuits, something about how you can distinguish different switching characteristics, and something that relates to many of the talks we've seen this week is something about two component modules. So here's an example discovered way back in the early 70s, 60s, that you could have the induction of gene expression occur by two fundamentally different mechanisms. A negative mode of control in which you've got something that's blocking a promoter which is normally active, and you have to remove that blocking agent in order to get induction. Alternatively, you can have a quiescent gene. You have to supply something that activates that and stimulates expression. So as you go from the left to the right, you've got exactly the same physiology, if you like, induction, specific induction of some gene, and yet it's being realized by two different molecular mechanisms. And the question is that an accident, or is there some rule there? And again, I'm not going to go through all the details of this, but to tell you that there is a rule, and that it says that you expect a positive mode of control when there's a high demand for expression of that gene, the regulated gene, in the organism's natural environment. So if you think of a regulatory characteristic, some sigmoid shape, and if it's operating at the high end of that, most of the time in the natural environment, you'll select for a positive mode of control. Okay? On the other hand, if you're at the low end of that regulatable region, most of the time in the natural environment, you'll select for a negative mode of control.
And it removes the block when
you say negative. Yes. And so, and as I say, I'm not going to go through the details of the argument here. This is an old story. But that you can test this in about 100 different cases in bacteria where you know something about the environment to know whether a gene is on or off most of the time, and something about the molecular mechanism to know whether it's positive or negative. Yes?
High demand means that when you're expressing it, you need large quantities?
No.
You tend to express it frequently?
It's more at the high end of its regulatable range most of the time. So it's more frequency related, and not, well, we speak of capacity for regulation as a difference between the basal and the fully expressed level. So I think of that as the capacity for regulation. Demand means how often are you up high versus low. Right, exactly.
So when you're sort of defining a natural environment, you're meaning the environment in which that particular gene is most highly expressed?
I think of the life cycle, say, of the organism. So suppose you could monitor the activity of a gene throughout the life cycle of the organism, and you found that it was only on for a blip early in development or something, it was off the rest of the time. That would be a low demand function. It's turned off most of the time, occasionally it's turned on. If you had something that was on all the time except off for a small blip, you'd say that's high demand. It's on most of the time. And actually, we can quantify what we mean by high and low in a very quantitative fashion. This is a story that's old. I don't want to get into the details. We can talk about it later, perhaps. And it's an interesting story. But just before lunch, it's a story that gets you into the gut ecology and so forth. I'd rather avoid it. Yeah. That's the counterintuitive part that many people sense in this the first time you hear it. And you have to think through the selection. Take the wild type, let's say it's a positively controlled system in an environment where it's needed all the time. If you mutate the regulatory system, it gets turned off constitutively. Those organisms don't grow. They get weeded out, those mutants. So you select for the positive control. And you can go through the argument for the negative. And it's, anyway, there's lots of examples that will support this. And I'll just give you one extension of this, because originally it was that argument was developed for an organism which is in sort of a single demand regime, if you like. But if you apply that rule in a very straightforward, dumb fashion to regulation of differentiated cell-specific functions, you come up with a surprising prediction as well. So here's an example of a very elementary developmental system that has two different differentiated states, if you like. Bacteriophage lambda growing lytic virus. We heard about this yesterday, where you've got lytic functions out on the ends here that have to be expressed when it's growing lytically. So those are in high demand, and you've got an end gene product, which is an anti-terminator or a positive control, which is necessary for expression of those genes. On the other hand, C1 is a gene which is in low demand when it's growing as a lysogen. Therefore, low demand should be negative control, and there's another gene here that codes for repressor, CRO, which blocks expression of that. So these two regulators fit exactly those ideas of demand when it's growing as a lysogen. Now what happens when it flips to grow, and it grows as a lytic virus? When it's a lysogen, things are just reversed. Now you don't want these lytic functions expressed. So they're in low demand. They're turned off. Low demand says it should be under negative control. Of course, that's C1. It blocks expression to the right and left promoters. Keeps those off, so that fits with the demand. Now C1 is one of the few lysogen-specific functions, which is in high demand. It has to be there all the time to maintain the repressed state. And in fact, it's an activator of its own expression. So high demand, positive control. So everything fits in here. And in fact, you see a switching of the modes of control during differentiation. And this switching is brought out by the interlocking circuitry of phage lambda. Yeah.
Is there no cost to having, because in the second one, in the negative, you have to have the genome all the time to be transcribed.
Right.
There's no cost to the genome?
And we'll get into this in the details of the analysis shortly, and that is that we always control for things like that. So the regulators are both expressed when you have positive and negative control in here, so that the, if you like, the energetic demand is really controlled out in the comparisons. Yeah. Right. There's still ongoing work on this, and that's why I said if you just apply the rule dumbly to each of the states, it still seems to apply in many of these cases where you've got simple systems. What we have to go through is the analysis of that. What are the demands and the frequencies of switching and all of that that will maintain that control system? My guess is that in both environments, in your colon and out there in the lakes and streams, it's growing very slow. Where you get bursts are when it's colonizing, if you like, and when it's maybe going to another environment, all of a sudden exposed to oxygen, and you may get some ability to oxidize things that you couldn't do in the colon. It's a more complicated story, and you're right. I don't want to go into the details of that. But there is a hint of how you approach that problem, because what I told you about in the early stories here was just looking at the specific regulators of each of these systems. When you combine it with the fact, say, for example, in the LAC operon, that there's both the negative specific regulator, the LAC repressor, and CAP cyclic AMP as a global regulator, you actually get demands for each of the regulators that you have to analyze, and there has to be overlap and logic that goes with that, and you actually come up with some interesting predictions about the phasing of expression of these things. And I think that relates to this differentiation business as well. But that's another story. I don't want to dwell on that. This is really the outline of what I like to do. Is still this, that was just to give you an example that you can come up with a rule, and it helps you understand. And you notice I really abstracted out. There were no details about what kinds of enzymes were being regulated and the kinetic properties of those, the KMs and the Vmaxes, all of that. And now I want to tell you a little bit about the methodology of how we control out all those specific differences that certainly are going to exist in real systems. So I want to emphasize again that we want to look at large classes of circuits so that we have many examples to test our ideas. The kind of analysis and comparison I'm doing would be very difficult if I only had one of a kind. There would be nothing to compare with except imaginary ones that I would dream up. So we look at things like inducible catabolic circuits in bacteria, where we know there's an order of 100 in E. coli. And so if we can come up with some rules, we've got lots of tests. And as I said before, the main goals are two, is if there is something that is nearly universal that you see in all these, we'd like to somehow understand why. But more likely in cases where there are alternatives, can we just come up with the rules that distinguish those alternatives? So what's required for this? Well, as I said, I oftentimes want to look at alternatives that may no longer have existed. They've been eliminated in evolution or something. I want a representation that I feel is plastic enough or general enough to capture the essence, at least, of those systems. We want constraints that reduce the space of comparisons, because if it's a huge space of comparisons in, you know, n dimensions, the combinatorial problems of looking at different parameters and stuff is impossible. If we can reduce that space to something that we can think about, either both analytically or numerically, then that's going to be very important. And then, of course, we need methods to extract the implications that are implicit in those system equations, and that's just the usual mathematical tools. And finally, when we get results, we want to compare them against some battery of criteria. And these are going to be quantitative criteria that we use for judging the effectiveness of those systems. That will depend, so this is the mathematical framework that we work in. These generalized mass action systems, or in many cases where we can group net synthesis into net degradation. That's a very useful form because in looking at the steady state, you have some nice analytical tools.
Can you just tell us what the labels are that
you're looking
for? I'm sorry. This is a product of power functions. So this is like mass action if these exponents were small integer values, ones, twos.
So what are the
Okay. This is just telling you that you're looking at some concentration in your system. Its rate of change is going to have processes which produce that. And there could be several of these, so you sum over all of those. And each process is a product of power functions. Mass action, if you like, is a special case of this. And similarly for the degradative terms. Now, this is generalized mass action in the sense that these exponents don't have to be small integer values. They can be real numbers, positive, negative, fractional values. So, when I want to talk about comparisons, I want to draw on sort of the tradition of what good experimental biology has always been about, and that is you're dealing with very complex systems, most of which you don't know anything about. You want to focus on some part of that, and you want to control out the rest of that background that you don't know anything about. And a good control experiment or good controls are designed to try and do that. I'm going to try and do that mathematically, and in fact, it's an idealized kind of control comparison. So we start off with two designs that are represented in sort of this general form. We take one of them to be a reference. And we don't have to know all the parameters for that system. We'll just say that we've got one system, which we'll take as a given. You can think of that as the wild type. And then we're going to restrict the differences to be in a single process. So think of two designs that differ by a change in one process, like a mutation, which changes one enzyme. Okay? Everything else, we assume, is unchanged or isogenic. As I said, we take one to be the reference. By having everything else isogenic, that is, component by component in these two systems, if you assume they're identical, we call that internal equivalence. That is, within the system, things that haven't changed by this mutation are going to be assumed to be exactly the same. So that's internal equivalence. But the fact that we've changed one thing, that's going to change some of the parameters. And that introduces degrees of freedom, new degrees of freedom in the comparison. I'm changing one process, and in general, I'll assume that that mutation could affect, in general, everything about that process. Could it change the activity, could change the binding, could change lots of things. At this point, I'm not. The process could be an enzyme, it could be a transport, anything that.
Changing,
no, one of the rates that's affecting. Right. Well, alpha, beta, or the G's or H's, okay? So the fact that I've changed one process, that mutation is going to alter things about that one process, changes the KM, changes the Vmax, you know, whatever you want to think about that. That introduces degrees of freedom. And if I make comparisons without dealing with those degrees of freedom, I can make almost anything come out of this. So I'm going to restrict those degrees of freedom, by insisting on external equivalence. That is, if these two systems are designed to perform some important function, I'm going to insist that they can still both do that. And and each constraint of that nature reduces one of the degrees of freedom until I eliminate all the unique parameters so I have no more degrees of freedom. When I do that and have systems both internally and externally maximally equivalent, I've got this so constrained that I have, whatever differences come out of that are the essential differences I can't get rid of.
Michael, what's that mean biologically? What does that mean biologically?
Well, let me, this is in words and I'm going to show you step by step this, and I think it'll answer that. If it doesn't, ask me again.
So the notion is that the specified process can only be realized in only one way, so that there isn't some large manifold of parameters which will satisfy all your post constraints.
It'll maybe become clear when we go through a specific example, but the idea is that when you mutate this process, there are lots of accidental things that might happen, lots of different kinds of mutational results, if you want to think of it that way. And out of that whole spectrum of mutations, I'm going to select those that have particular parameter values that make these two systems as identical as possible. So it's a minimally effective mutant.
I think maybe another way to rephrase that is he's going to resolutely restrict the submanifold of things where the parameters in that submanifold are the ones that give certain input output properties.
I think the example may help this, but one more, yeah.
Yeah, so you still provide some sort of metric for what external equivalent is.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
And you choose what that hierarchy is based on the notion of what you think is
correspond. Exactly, yeah.
The functions here just mean steady state concentrations of species X sub I?
Not necessarily. There are going to be several criteria that we'll look at. And I'll show you those in a minute. But the point is that once I fix these systems to be as identical as I can make them, I mean, you could imagine if I could make them exactly identical in all their behaviors, it would mean that difference, that mutation, was irrelevant or be neutral in some sense or whatever. But typically, that's not what happens. You get some differences that remain that you can't get rid of, even though you've made them as identical as possible by this method. And then what you do when you've got those two alternatives, and then analyze them to death and see what differences remain. And those are the ones that come out of this. And you compare them on the basis of these quantitative criteria. So what are the criteria we use? Here are some examples. We talk about decisiveness, that is, we talk about thresholds for something happening at a precise value. We talk about efficiency, how much you get out of a given increment of induction, say. You think of energy in that as well. Selectivity, when we have some control system that changes the expression of a gene, it doesn't interfere with other genes. Robustness, that is, you can change the parameters and it doesn't really affect the performance of the system. Talk about stability, again, you perturb the system and it doesn't, you know, bear off into other states. Responsiveness, how fast it can respond in some environment, in these changing environments, that's an important criteria. So we look at all these you can quantify and ask how well does each design perform based on these criteria. We argue that these are all important under some circumstances for the organism. Now, you could think of others, and of course, depends on the physiology of the system you're working with, and if you're a biologist who's studied something for many years, you have some good intuitions about what criteria might be relevant to compare your designs. Okay, so that's words, and I want to go through some examples, if we have time, three of them, to show you what comes out of this kind of approach. So the first is an example with two different forms of coupling in gene expression. And here's an example. Go back to the HUD operon, Salmonella, where this is an abstraction of that, but you've got a transcriptional unit here where you're taking nucleotide precursors into specific mRNA, activated amino acids into enzymes and regulator, and the enzymes are catalyzing the conversion of substrates to intermediates to products, and there's an inducer in here which is affecting this. So this is an example of perfect coupling between the effector functions of the enzymes and the regulator of the system because it's in the same transcriptional unit. So it gets co-regulated. So that we think of that as perfect coupling or autogenous control, if you like. So that's one design that's found in some.
Is that supposed to be feedback?
It depends. The inducer is positive, absolutely. And the enzyme can be negative or positive.
The way you're doing it, you're positive.
Well, I haven't indicated one or the other, but because this is an inducer, it's positive, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, well, let's compare that with a case that's completely uncoupled. So here you have the regulator in some other transcriptional unit, and it affects this transcription here. But now, when you induce this enzyme, say 1,000-fold, this regulator is not changing at all, so they're completely uncoupled. So the question is, what difference does that make, that extra feedback loop within the system? And can you discover when it would be useful for an organism to evolve one or the other of these designs? Well, I'm not going to go into the details, but you can write equations that look in that form. And what I'm saying by internal equivalence is all the parameters in the unaffected processes are exactly the same. That's internal equivalence. So all these in the reference system over here, I'll take these as given to me, even though I don't know what they are, these parameters. And over here is the altered system. And the only process that's different is this one. And if I take this as the given, this is my reference, I know everything here. The only thing I don't know are these two parameters that have been mutated somehow. Okay, so I've got to fix those degrees of freedom, those two, that kinetic order and the kinetic order and the rate constant. I want to fix those to make these two systems behave similarly and not have some accidental difference cloud the results. So what do I take to be the same? Well, these are inducible systems, and this is a typical induction characteristic where you would take cultures and put them in different concentrations of the inducer and measure how much of the product is induced in these steady state conditions, and you get an S-shaped kind of curve typically. And here's what we'd call the capacity for regulation, the difference between the basal and the fully expressed. And then you'd have some gain in function here, the amplification of this system that is produced. And if I insist that those two designs produce exactly the same steady state induction characteristics, that's my external equivalence. I'm going to insist that because that's what an inducible system should do. If I allow this to have a very low gain or a different capacity or something, it wouldn't be a fair comparison anymore. Okay? So if I can eliminate this difference, that's good. So if I say that I want them to have the same induction characteristic, what does that do to those parameters? It tells me how I've got to choose them. Okay, and it looks a little complicated, but over here on the right are all the parameters that are given to me in the reference. I just, you know, and this tells me how I've got to choose these in relation to those such that I get them to both have this identical characteristic. Yeah? Yeah.
You're only allowing yourself to vary the parameters in what you call sort of the mutation and allowing them vary so that you still reproduce those features. And I guess I missed the logic of why, if you want to understand why this pathway versus that pathway, why wouldn't you also allow yourself to vary all the parameters?
Well, that's a different problem. And I'm asking, really, what is that extra feedback loop they're doing? If you're varying some of the parameters, you're also asking, what happens if I change the activity of this enzyme and the binding of that and this? And those will be changes.
But let's suppose you construct the feedback loop and you find that for no values of your parameter can you reproduce that curve. But what if you find that actually I could twiddle some parameter in one of the other equations and get back that curve? It wouldn't be fair to then say, well, the reason bugs don't have a feedback is in order to get that curve. Right?
Treating the rest of the system as rigid, but it could adapt and buffer some of your mutation, right?
Some of those
alphas are biochemical parameters, but others will be concentrations of some other enzyme, the levels of expression, this or that, which conceivably can adapt, right?
But you see, the goal here is to try and make these two designs as identical as possible. And this is like a mutation that occurs in biology. When it first occurs on the scene, it's competing with its parent.
Okay, so the logic is you're really thinking of it as a
sort of, well, these things are one step away from each other in a sense. Yeah.
You wouldn't, by this analysis, try to conclude that the architecture that the other, you can't really make statements about the architecture in isolation. It's only in some sense stability for against mutation.
Well, it's in the context of a reference and what a piece of that architecture contributes to the behavior. I mean, if you allow everything to change, then it's like you're comparing E. coli and elephants in a way after a while, and that's very difficult.
But you'll get to show the different characteristics of these two systems.
Well, as I go on, what I'm going to show is there still are differences, and those differences allow you to come up with a rule that you can then test. And then in the end, that's my, you know, gold standard, if I can find examples which seem to fit this.
But your approach would allow you to do, ask them what, I mean, these questions could be asked when you want.
Yeah.
So you, just right here, you're focusing on, what you can constrain and leave free whatever you choose.
Yeah.
But what you're asking could be done.
Right.
It'd be just a different question.
Yeah.
No. This is too much community constraint to demand that those reductions of risk are exactly the same.
Well, this is an ideal comparison. I'm maybe even better. I mean, you could try and do this. In fact, Uri Alon has done a control comparison experimentally where he's come very close to this and tested some of these ideas experimentally. What I'm showing you here is the mathematical idealized comparison where I'm able to eliminate as many of these other factors without...
I guess I'm not in trouble by that. Because, you have your mutation, and by imposing the constraints, you are allowing compensatory mutations.
Well,
right. But you choose to localize them to.
Well, let me. Here's another way to think.
Equation that. You allow to vary, but.
Right. Here's another way to think about that, though. Instead of right. Another way is the experience of people who, for example, got feedback-resistant mutants. Okay, you eliminate a feedback interaction by a mutation or an enzyme. And then you look at revertants. And what you get is a whole spectrum of revertants that regain that feedback inhibition to different degrees. And I'm working in that space. And I'm going to pick out of that whole spectrum of mutants the one that makes it the closest. That's all. And I can do this mathematically much more precisely than I could do that maybe experimentally. But yeah, let me go on here. So here's a very convenient way to represent the parameters in these circuits in a simple design space, where every point in here is a particular design. And the parameters that are important here, of course, is that we're dealing with the upper part of this because it's an induction system. So this is the effect of the inducer. It's a positive one. The regulator could either be an activator or a repressor. If I'm talking about repressor control, I'm talking about the upper left-hand quadrant. And there's a limitation on the size of these kinetic orders because they're limited. They can't be any larger than the number of binding sites on these regulatory proteins. So we're talking about small integer values that determine the size of this box. So the shaded region then are the realizable repressor control systems. A given line across here at an angle referred to as a given capacity for regulation or a given gain of that induction characteristic, a given slope. So these are low gain systems, intermediate and high gain. I said there are about a half a dozen different criteria for functional effectiveness that we've analyzed after imposing those constraints. And to make the story short, everything gets better as you move out to the left. Okay? So if you compare the uncoupled system here, which is on this axis where the regulator is not varying so it doesn't have an effect on the behavior. And then these are all the autogenous ones with different strengths of the repression. And it says that the best system is this green one out here on the edge. You go out as far as you can and that's the optimum. That means it's more robust, it's more stable, it responds faster, and so forth. If you have a higher gain, again, you move out to here, and if you have a very high gain, you can only have this little corner spot here. They're kind of related, actually. You could, because the range over which these regulators act is about 30-fold, it's pretty common. So here's the formula for that line of equivalence that just tells you what that is. And of course, here's the case with the activators. Now you're talking about the right-hand business here. Here's the boundary of stability. So we have to be in the shaded region. Again, you move as far as you can to the left. This says that the uncoupled systems are best. When you're a positively regulated system, these are worse, and so forth. So Irish, you're seeing two different predictions. You're saying that you should have, in the case of repressor-controlled, perfect coupling, and in the case of activator-controlled, complete uncoupling. Those are the best designs. And I told you that there's a rationale or rule for positive and negative to begin with. So let me give you an example of an analytical result that comes out of this that isn't dependent on the parameter values. Okay, so looking at the robustness of the system, which we define in terms of the parameter sensitivities. So if the function of the system is insensitive to variations in the parameters, which we measure this way, the change in some flux, say, in relation to a change in the parameter multiplied by that, or it's the logarithmic derivative of this, we want those to be small. Okay, and here's the condition for external equivalence, so that these two systems are equivalent. Now, if we calculate this for the two systems, so here's the perfectly coupled system. We'll go through that calculation. You'll get some expression that's complicated. You can do the same thing for the uncoupled system, and you get another expression that's kind of complicated. And if you just try to compare them directly, it's like comparing apples and oranges because of that, those degrees of freedom. But if I insert this constraint now into this, wherever I saw this unique parameter in the uncoupled system, now I'd have everything in terms of oranges. Everything is in terms of the parameters of the reference system. Many things cancel out, and you're left with this simple expression, which is very easy to interpret because all these parameters are positive except for G12. If you've got a repressor control, that's negative. And so if you, here's the common thing, and you're adding something more to the denominator, it's always going to be less than 1, no matter what those parameters are. So that says that for repressor control or negative control, that the perfectly coupled system is more robust than the equivalent uncoupled system. Always. If it's activator control where G12 is positive, now you're subtracting something from the denominator and it's going to get bigger than 1, it says that the uncoupled system is more robust. Okay, so again, you're seeing the differences go one way or the other depending on whether it's positively or negatively controlled. V is any flux. And so three happens to be the flux through X sub 3 pool. The flux through the X sub 3 pool in this case.
So, I mean, I'm just trying to understand the quality of
the Yeah.
So, is the idea that this thing is trying to get to some homeostatic state, and that when you have fluctuations, if the repressor is going up with the fluctuation, you basically get a quadratic gain in concentration, where it's kept fixed concentration the repressor, and only the enzyme is fluctuating, then you only get a linear feedback that brings you back to your
okay. I guess I think of that differently. I think of your DVD player or whatever. You've got signals that you're trying to amplify, you know, the changes in the fluctuation of the laser, whatever, and then you've got to have a big signal, which is the boom box that's giving you the music coming out. So if it's a function to amplify those signals, that's going to be a large thing. That's not what I mean by sensitivity. That is, in a way, a very sensitive response, if you like. But think of the design of the hardware that you want to realize that high gain in a very robust fashion, so that as you change the parameters, the age, the temperature changes, so that you don't change the amplification. That's the sensitivity. So it's the insensitivity of the system design, but it can be a very high gain amplifier. These induction systems can induce 1,000-fold. Okay, I misunderstood.
Okay. So you're assuming that the function is to have a particular gain. You don't want the amount of gain to fluctuate. Okay, so what is the thing that you pay? What is the function? What's that in the circuit? What behavior is that? What behavior is
that? In one design, if you change any of the other parameters, change an enzymatic activity, a rate constant or a Km or whatever, in the one design, that will have a bigger effect on the induction than in the system, which is more robust.
So you show this curve, you say this is the ideal curve.
Yeah.
So is the amount of the, is the cost just the integrated deviation from that curve when you change parameters? What is
What is the mathematical definition of cost?
When there is a lack of robustness, that.
Robustness of what? Of what function of the engine?
Of everything that it's doing in terms of its induction characteristic, or it can be the margins of stability, as we'll talk about those as well. In this case, they're looking at all the fluxes and all of the concentrations in this analytical calculation.
This is flux around one state.
Yes, in this case.
Is it the repressive state or the active
state? Any steady state in this induction characteristic that you hold it at a fixed inducer concentration or given substrate concentration.
In that case, is it an effect of saturation that the fluxes are at some kind of max anyway?
No, we can do this in the mid range if you like.
And, I agree with the sentiment that if there were some sort of more qualitative ways of understanding why this happens, that would be great.
Why robustness, in a general sense, is selection, is selected?
Why are we in regions where, for example, the high stress, Professor Kapil's circuit, is showing less change in flux, okay, in response to parameter changes, like in the extreme case, why is it so? There must be a one-sentence way.
Well, maybe I'm too close to it, and that has been so obvious to me. But let me go on one more. I'll show you a numerical comparison, which maybe gets at this, and I can give you the qualitative understanding of that. Here is the response time of these two systems. So here is the uncoupled, negatively controlled system with zero, completely uncoupled. And here is the negative system when you add in the repressor, autogenously regulated. And what I said before is you move on that line, things get faster. So here's a faster response time. Why is that happening? Some people have, in fact, thought that's counterintuitive. You're inducing a repressor, which should make things slower. What that does is allow you to start off very rapidly with very little repression, and yet, as you get up here, as you've induced the repressor, you rein it in. And that brings it to the maximal level. When you have an activator control system, here's the uncoupled case, and here's the perfectly coupled case. Now what happens is you, since the activator is tending to push this along, you've got to start off keeping that in check, or it'll run away.
The key to this is that you normalize for steady, two steady state levels are the same.
They have the same induction characteristic, yeah. Yeah.
So are you saying that one cannot design a positive feedback circuit which will be as fast as a negative?
No. That's the whole point of controlling these out.
But that
I can change.
That is bothering me very much.
Yeah, but that's right. But wait a second. How would you do that?
Parameters if you allow yourself to vary very much.
No, but you'd have to change parameters in such a way that you could make this curve go faster than this one. But that wouldn't be in my control comparison anymore.
But you define this control comparison.
Right.
And what if I allow myself to vary somewhat different parameters?
You give me the positive control that you want to be as fast as you make, you know, whatever it is. That's my reference. I'll now mutate that and come up with an uncoupled case that'll be faster yet. With your parameters.
Well, fine, you're making very strong statements.
Well, that's what I would do, though, is that's the whole purpose of doing these controls, because you can always up the kinetic parameters for everything and make it go faster. This whole diagram could be shifted one way or the other. And what I'm trying to do is whatever you're giving me as a reference, if you want to make this very fast, we'll make it, you know, done in a millisecond or something. Whatever parameters it took to do that, make that very fast. All I'm saying is if I keep all those parameters the same in the mutated system, but pick those, the particular parameter, I can make this one faster.
My problem is that you have allowed yourself to change parameters only in one equation, right? And we can choose to even change the same number of parameters, right? But all over the place, right?
The other parameters, you give me a set of parameters that you want for the reference system, and that can be all over the place. Exactly. But once you fix that, then the way I would choose the mutation.
But will it give the same result? Will you still conclude that the
Yes, that's what comes out of this.
That's the story.
Yeah. That's what seems to come out of this, yes. That's the goal.
What's the y-axis exactly?
This is the flux through the product pool X3 in that inducible system. I'm sorry, that isn't very clear. So in other words, you're inducing this catabolic system, and how much carbon is flowing into the organism through that inducible system. And it's normalized to the maximum steady state.
You're asking what the better way to control the system is when you go from off to on, whether it's by activation or repression. True?
No, we've already told you the rule of that with the positive or negative business. Now I'm saying that this is another level where I'm asking now, how are you going to couple these genes to get desirable properties?
I guess here's my question. What if you took your exact same system you're looking at here, and you said, now I want to ask this robustness or better, whatever is better, to go from on to off?
Yeah, you could. Sure.
I mean, it would still be coupled versus uncoupled, and the repressor versus activator
yes.
would still hold true.
Yeah. Okay. So that came up with a prediction about when you'd expect each of these forms of coupling to occur. And in fact, you can generalize that to having a regulator circuit here and an effector circuit here, where the coupling doesn't have to be perfect or completely uncoupled. You can have induction of these effector functions and at the same time induce the regulator. We'd call that directly coupled. And you can actually repress the regulator function at the same time that you're doing induction of these effector functions, or these could be uncoupled. And those are the three logical possibilities. And again, you can go through the analysis, and it turns out that you make the same sorts of predictions, that when you've got high gain, small capacity, you get inversely coupled. This high demand means positive regulation, if you like. If it's a large capacity system, and now this is a new factor, if you like. We're now looking at the capacity that you brought up earlier, whether it's large or small.
What does it mean, large or small, compared to what?
Capacity is the difference between the basal and the maximal level of expression. So a high capacity system, say, lac, 1,000-fold. Pardon? Yeah. Think of the largest that you can come up with and the smallest that you can come up with, if you like. So here's the prediction for the positively controlled systems. That is that you expect inverse coupling when there is a low capacity for expression. And you expect direct coupling when there is a high capacity. So here's the gradient and capacity. Here's the highest one we found, ethanolamine. And here's a mirror system down.
Less than a factor of 10 or less than a factor of 2?
Well, here is the ratio of the two is less than 10. And here it's greater than 10 to the fourth. Okay? Yep. It's the highest one we could find. The closed are the positively regulated ones, and that's the direction that we predict from the analysis, is that there'd be a correlation in this direction. The negative ones, you expect the correlation in this direction. For low capacity, you expect direct coupling, so everything's reversed. And if you had high capacity here, you'd expect inverse coupling. We haven't found any in the literature down here, and we're not sure of the reason for that, but now, of course, there's a lot of scatter in this, and these were done. Every one of these spots is, 15 years of some lab's life, done under different conditions sometimes. Sometimes they don't report the variation in regulator level much because they're often hard to measure and so forth, but perhaps now these could be done much better with more recent technology. But in general, there is that correlation. Yeah?
So going back to this book, when you have this complicated set of kinetic equations, models, and networks, and you choose, you're going to compare two particular networks. And so it seems like the important point is that what your conclusions from that analysis are globally true in all the other parameters. That, at least in this example, it sounded like that was what you're claiming. Is that always going to be true?
I don't know that would always be true, but
in all the examples you've
the way we set this analysis up is that you're given a reference. And we're not saying where those parameters have to be, because many times we don't know. But if we can change it in a specific way, usually to look at the presence or absence of some regulation, and do it in a way which keeps everything else controlled and the same, whatever differences come out of that, we want to say that that's something we can attribute specifically to that regulation.
But only a small number of gene 1-2s or whatever they are actually describe the regulation itself, right? A lot of them are rates of enzyme reactions and gene expression and stuff like that.
So, right.
I mean, there's only a small number you can change that would actually change the topology of the network, right?
Yes.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that's an answer to the question.
Can I just ask a few things about the... So, there are a lot of... What is that U line that's uncoupled? And
here...
line zero of...
These are the uncoupled ones in the dotted line. The ratio of... And it's not changing, so the ratio of the maximum to the basal is one. That's the uncoupled ones along that line. That would be no change in the regulator between, in other words, its basal and its maximum are the same, therefore the ratio, log of the ratio, is zero. So these are the uncoupled ones. Here are the positive...
I thought uncoupled ones, they were just not in the same operon, but there was a change in response to...
When they were completely uncoupled, the regulator level didn't change. That's what you mean by this, uncoupled. So you go back. Uncoupled. No.
Uncoupled means
that the level is not changing.
The same operon, right?
Well, it means, yes.
Independently regulated.
It means, in this case, it means it's not changing while this is changing. It means that the regulator can still influence this, but its concentration is not influenced by what's going on over here. So it's like there's a cut in that wire, for example.
But, I mean, is the concentration of active within the regulator that is matters, right? Not the absolute concentration of the total amount of activated molecules.
Now we're thinking of that as the amount of the regulator, because the variation in what goes on is the details of the mechanism of how this might occur, and at this level of the analysis, we're not getting into those details.
Mike, yeah. What would you predict if we put the LAC-IG in the LAC-OP?
If you could do it in this control way, so that you didn't influence a lot of other things, do it. You'd expect that's the experiment that Urey's done, actually. Not exactly that one, but he's put a regulator moved it into its own transcriptional unit, and you find that it improves the response time. Now, you're right. Now, I wouldn't predict that for the LAC operon. It goes back to that business of the gain. LAC is a very high gain system, and so, that gets more complicated. It has to do with the capacity. LAC is already a high capacity system. You won't get that same effect with the LAC. I mean, I think this is one example where you probably can't construct that. Let me see if I can go back to that space. Okay, so here's a high gain system. Here's LAC, if you like, and that's why it's uncoupled, because it's so high. The only realization is the classic case, the uncoupled case. If you could reduce the gain of the LAC operon and put it in out here, then from that reduced gain system out to here, you'd see an improvement. But what I'm arguing from this kind of diagram is that LAC seems to be very close to this corner up here with its high capacity. And so if you wanted to add the autogenous component, put it in its own transcription unit, you're asking to go out on this line out here beyond the point where you can realize that. Okay, that says that you'd have to, instead of having a kinetic order, which is 4 or whatever because of the quaternary structure of a repressor or something, you'd have to come out here to 6 or 8 or something. You can't realize that.
Is that really true that the tetraceptor is not as high gain because it's so tight?
You have to look at the... Well, he also did a mixture, actually, of experimental and theoretical gates. I shouldn't go into that. Yeah.
How do I decide if it's a high gain, a low gain, or intermediate gain system before I start trying to model it?
I would go by the scale on those diagrams. High gains, I think of like LAC, the ethanolamine ones.
So that's like a number of molecules per cell.
I'm thinking of 1,000-fold is high, whereas histidine or something is Hutt system is like 18, 15, something like that. It's lower.
So it gives you the feeling that if the cell only was allowed to, it could produce 1,000 histidines. Do you have that?
No. I'm saying the capacity is 15 in the Hiss system from basal to saturation. That's what you observe, 15-fold. So if that's your system...
But why is that low and not high?
Well, that has to do with the metabolism of the cell, whether it needs... something like lactose can carry all the carbon flow for the whole organism, so it's a huge capacity system, whereas a vitamin might be very low capacity system because you only need a few molecules to... So the things like that which will set those capacities that are independent of the regulation I'm talking about here.
So let's remove one of the operators in the LAC system. The gain has gone from 1,000 to 30. And so the statement is that if that were the case, you would redesign the feedback.
Okay, so if that turned it into a low capacity system, or low gain system, such that we're on a line like this, and this was the position of the LAC, then I would say yes, adding that.
So what would you do? So we remove the operator, and how do we redesign the system to reoptimize it?
Well, it was a good question that Tom asked. Can we then take and splice out the LAC I gene and put it in between beta-galactosidase and the promoter and make it such that its level varies with expression of the other regulated genes?
Right, and what does that and that will just make it faster?
That would make it faster.
It would also make it weaker because you get the repressor when it's weaker.
Well, what I said is if you can do this in this control way, you have to realize that we've got all these other parameters that we're holding constant. When you make those changes, you're going to have all kinds of things that may differ. So you'd have to go look at it very carefully to see, because if you change the state, sure, you change some of those other parameter values. One of the things about these control comparisons is that you're maintaining the same state when you do the comparison, say, about a given steady state. And so you've got to make sure that if you're trying to replicate these ideals in a real experiment, it's not going to be easy. Sometimes you will have to change the activity or lower the activity such that you get the same state. I'm afraid we're not going to get some of the examples if we keep going on this, but... In fact... Given the track record so far, I'm wondering if I should even do this one and skip to the last one because it relates more to the other talks that you had here. Tell you what, I'll do the last one, and if there is some time or somebody's interested, I'll come back and repeat this. So let me see how we'll do this. Okay, so here are two alternate designs for an idealized two-component module, kind that we talked about in a way, but again, abstracted out to get at what I want to consider here, the essential features. Some signal, in this case, we know the signal, it's X sub 5. and here is the sensor protein in its unphosphorylated form, and when this signal will activate it in phosphorylate this, and it will pass it on to the response regulator, and this will affect some target gene its expression here. You can also have a non-cognate signal, which could be small phosphoester donors here. For the moment, we'll talk about that. But the point I want to emphasize in these two different designs, in this case, the unphosphorylated sensor stimulates, mechanism unknown, but stimulates the dephosphorylation, the phosphatase activity, or whatever, of the response regulator. And in this case, it doesn't. So this response regulator is monofunctional, and it only passes it on to the response regulator. Here it does that, but in addition, it can activate the dephosphorylation. Okay? What I'm going to say is, again, that the only difference is going to be in this process, and everything else I'll make identical for these two systems.
So you're not going to allow yourself to change the, say, the phosphorylation rate or strength, the ability to transfer phosphate to the response rate?
Again, I'll allow you to set whatever levels you want in a reference, and then we'll do the control such that that's taken care of. Okay. So again, I won't go through there. These equations are actually much more complicated. There are lots of constraints between the conserved moieties and so forth, but boils down to a simplified equation, the way I've represented it here anyway, where many of these things are the same. Here is the difference in the monofunctional case. We don't have the interaction of the unphosphorylated regulator here, or the sum of the phosphorylated and unphosphorylated regulator that influences this system.
Wait, I didn't see
X sub 7. That's the total amount. X sub 7 is the total amount of the sensor protein, the phosphorylated plus unphosphorylated form, and that's conserved on this time scale. And X sub 8 is the same thing for the response regulator, phosphorylated and unphosphorylated. Again, here is the signal amplification. If you look at the change in the X sub 5, the signal at the input, and ask how much change in the phosphorylated regulator you get out here, I'm going to get some kind of a sigmoid curve like this, where again we talk about a capacity and a gain or amplification of the signal as it goes from input to output. And again, I would like that to be the same in some sense for these two systems. And here's where you can do it in several different ways, but the qualitative results are really much the same. One is to say, since I'm talking about these two signals, a primary signal and a secondary signal, is if I wanted the amplification in response to the primary signal to be the same for both, I'm going to ask what happens to the response to the secondary signal. Alternatively, I could do the other way around and say, make the secondary response the same in the two. How does it differ in its response to the primary signal? I'm going to talk about response time, amplification, robustness, stability, you know, all those things again. But to get the same amplification factor, again, that's what fixes the two parameters in the monofunctional sensor. And it's in relation to all these complicated parameters of the bifunctional one. This is an idealization I claim captures the essential features of this. It's a sigmoid kind of curve. You could do this with more complicated expressions, and I would claim you'd get the same basic result. This does make the analysis a lot simpler.
But how do you actually compute the numbers out of your equations? You
can't. I'm given the parameters in the equation, which I represent in the power law form and so forth, and it's got these three different regions. It's got a basal level expression, the maximal, and in between there, a logarithmic gain that I can calculate. And when I equate the calculation in the two systems, in one system, the reference system, I have all these given parameters, and the other system, I've got this unique parameter, and I equate those gains, this tells me how I have to choose that parameter. Gain is the slope in this log-log plot.
Slope where? Which is
now, in this formula, this will be a straight line in this log-log plot because of these power functions. So if this is 2, I mean, it's going to be a quadratic kind of similar to a Hill coefficient of 2 in here. If it's a 4, it would be like 4. So this is capturing the essential features of that. It rounds out. If you do this with a rational function, you'll tend to get divots or rounding off in these corners, but this is a very good approximation. And it makes the analysis, it's very hard to do these comparisons with other forms, but with these, it's very straightforward. You calculate the gain in each of the two models, you equate them, and you solve for this unique parameter. That will ensure the same gain. So it's the same philosophy that, you know, you're insisting that certain things be the same, make them the same. It restricts what kind of mutation you pull out of the spectrum of mutants. Once you've got that, you do your comparisons. Okay, I'm going to summarize a lot of the analysis. The important results that come out of this are that what you find is that the bifunctional sensors amplify the primary signal and tend to attenuate the secondary signal. And so this is a design which tends to be useful if you think of that secondary signal as noise that you'd like to suppress.
In your model, you're saying that the sensor is either a kinase or a phosphatase. It can't be both.
The unphosphorylated form is the activator, yeah.
So it's either
yeah.
No, aren't you saying that the bifunctional sensor is both and the monofunctional sensor?
No. The two functions of the bifunctional sensor is the one that it can donate the phosphate group, and the other is that it can do the phosphatase, but they're not the same. Those are two different arrows in that diagram. Yes, right.
And you're assuming the signal only varies the kinase activity, is that
right? No, it's just phosphorylating the sensor. You want to go back to that diagram?
Yeah. So the X5 only modulates going from S to S star, does not modulate.
It can't change one without changing the other.
It's taking this and converting it to this. And this can donate this in this process. Here's the one function, and here's the other function.
They're both working on the same response.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if one function is adding a phosphate and the other function is helping get rid of it.
Helping, it's stimulating this rate of dephosphorylation. No, this is the unphosphorylated form which is doing this. This is the phosphorylated form that's doing that.
Oh, but it's the same sensor that is doing both.
Yeah.
The same sensor that's doing both activities in this case, and in B, the same sensor is only doing one activity.
That's right. That's the mono versus bi.
But I guess what I was asking was, you could imagine a model where the phosphatase for an unphosphorylated sensor kinase, its ability to dephosphorylate could be modulated by signal. You're not.
This could come down here somehow, yeah.
You're not.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
Right. So, Mike, in model B, it's just a spontaneous reaction to dephosphorylate that is regulated?
Some rate.
Not regulated.
Right.
So then you can.
This is just some spontaneous dephosphorylation.
And what's the primary signal and the secondary signal then?
This is the primary signal. And this is a secondary signal, which can result by some other phospho donor here, some small.
Okay.
Do this.
So you're trying to integrate it yet another level regulator.
Right. Okay.
In some systems, I believe in the absence of ATP, so it never phosphorylates itself, you can still modulate phosphatase activity. It's a possibility. Though.
Could be.
And I just also, I want to make sure that I've understood.
Yeah.
Would you say that one of the messages I'm getting from you is it's not enzyme kinetics that matter? It's not the parameters, it's the circuitry.
When I look at two different designs that have different circuitry, I'm trying to identify what that difference implies in terms of function.
It's circuitry.
It's circuitry that's mattering here.
It matters, not the enzyme.
Well, you have to optimize the enzyme kinetic parameters
Yeah, but no, even by optimizing the enzyme genetics, certain things are definitely certain.
Yes, that's right. That's the message.
Good.
Yes. I'll allow you to optimize the reference you give me, and then I can choose a circuit which might be better.
Exactly.
There's experimental evidence that small phosphodonors can carry out that. Other people are more experts than I am at this.
Extremely well. Small phosphodonors can get into the extremely well.
So, what about the monofunctional sensors? Well, that tends to, compared to the bifunctional sensor, it tends to attenuate the primary signal and amplify the secondary. And therefore, it would appear that this is better for integrating the functions of these two signals if you consider that crosstalk to be functional. So this would be a better integrator of signals. This would be a better suppressor isolator of signals.
So, yeah. Intuitively here, you want the total response to be the same. And you're saying either they're both linearly acting on the amount of response, or the primary signal is quadratically acting on it, and the other one only linearly, and then, yeah, it's quadratically acting, and the total response is the same, it's going to be more dominant in the case of the
both. Here's the way I think about it, that you have the two amplifications from in one design and another two in another design. If I equate the primary signals, which I'll consider these top fingers, you equate those, then in the bifunctional case, the secondary signal over here, I guess, is lower. It's attenuated compared to what it is in the monofunctional system. Alternatively, if I equate these two, then the primary signal is amplified. Pardon?
I understand the result.
Okay.
All
right. One is quadratic and one is linear, and so that's because of these log scales. That's the amplification. You're right. That you consider quadratic would have a gain of 2. And linear would gain of 1. So it's going to be more cooperative or amplify the signal more in the one case, in the bifunctional case here, when you're talking about the primary signal. And it'll do it less for the secondary. Well, that's what the analysis of the model says. Now, here's where I could get some help from the audience, people who are experts in this, but when would you want to suppress noise? Is the sensor of the osmotic pressure, is this a system where you have a signal where you'd like to isolate it from other kinds of things? Because if it responded by changing the permeability of the pores and so forth, that might be disruptive to the cell when it would like to ignore these things and focus on a particular function, even though I guess we don't know what the real signal is. As opposed to something like chemotaxis, where you've got maybe a primary signal, which is a gradient of nutrients somehow feeding into this, but you also have metabolism which feeds into this, and you want to integrate that. You don't want to spend a lot of energy chasing materials if you're already well fed. So this might be a system where you want to integrate metabolic needs and what's out there in the environment. Maybe you could think of others that would fit this notion, but when I heard Jim talk in the first day, he talked about many of the phosphorelay systems as ones that are integrating lots of signals. If this makes a better integrator, then maybe you don't want this sort of interaction. And as I recall, you said you didn't find those in some of those systems. Is that right?
I'm sure I didn't find
one. That the unphosphorylated form of the sensor was phosphatase. You don't. But anyway, that's what I would like to encourage those of you who are experts in this area to think about it, of whether these are systems designed in your particular case to be integrators or to be isolating it and focusing on a primary signal. This is a bit of speculation. Not only can we think of those small phosphoesters as donors, but suppose that you had crosstalk to a module. So consider this to be the module here, where this is the primary signal, primary sensor, and response regulator. But now here is another sensor which has some minor activity toward this response regulator. And here are, you know, four formal possibilities. If you compare them pairwise like this, so here is the case where you've got biregulator in the module, and here you've got monoregulator in the monofunctional regulator in the sensor in the module. This is a better design for isolating it against changes in this signal than, and here it would be better for integrating this signal. And similarly, if you do this comparison, again, this one is better at isolating, suppressing this signal. This is better at integrating these two together. So regardless of what the design is for this other sensor, it would say that, again, to minimize the crosstalk to a module, that is to isolate it better, you use this bifunctional design. On the other hand, if you're talking about crosstalk from a module, that is the same sensor communicating with two different response regulators. Okay, again, you compare this one, which is bifunctional, this one monofunctional. This one says that, let's see. Well, this one still is going to be better at suppressing. No, wait a second. I've got a mental block here. All right, I've got a block. I can't think of what that. Maybe I better stop there. One other thing is that we took from homology modeling two examples of well-studied and molecules where we've got the structure for a bifunctional sensor and a monofunctional sensor, which were different, and used those as templates to do structural modeling of hundreds of other sensors. And you tend to get these two different designs appearing over and over again. So if you do the same thing with the response regulators, they're all the same. And it's like Jim actually did it with the ones that have actually all been crystallized and show that they all look very similar. You get the same thing with homology modeling. We don't find any difference in the response regulators structures when you do it by homology modeling. But the sensors, you get these two different types coming out over and over again for hundreds of them. So it's if that functional difference, the kinetic difference in the suppression or amplification of signals somehow relates to this difference in the ATP lid of these sensor proteins. Now, whether that says that the activity is in the sensors or that these differences do something to the response regulator which uncovers the spontaneous activity, I don't think we can say anything about that. But it does appear that the differences reside in the sensors and not the response regulators. This is the ATP. ATP lid of the area of these two different kinds of sensors. This is OMP-Z. And this is key, whatever it is, the KA. I'm sorry, yeah. And then use those as templates to go into the data bank and look at all the homologous sequences. And whatever ones you can model, you tend to come up with these two. We don't.
But if you wanted the data bank for all the monofunctional sensors
in chemotaxis? All the ones that are chemotaxis, yes, were like this, if I recall.
Did you find others that have a certain function that are not chemotaxis?
A lot of the others, I mean, I have no idea what their functions are. They're just coming out of the sequence. But when you model them against the two different types, you either get this or this. In ones we can model. And that's all I'm saying is that's different from what you see with the response regulators. It's not clear that this is responsible for that phosphatase activity, but this is a difference that you do find in the sensors. Well, was going to say, what is common to these examples I've shown you, and I think what's common, and common to the one I didn't show you, is that they involve a limited number of possible variations on a theme. That is, I can't compare things that are so different. I'm looking at things where, in the case of the coupling, there were three logical possibilities: inverse, direct, uncoupled. So it's a small number of possibilities, so I can actually examine all of them. We also used relatively simple equations to get at the essential features of this. Those simple equations allowed us to actually do some qualitative analysis to get things that were independent of the parameters, which are fairly strong statements for part of that. And then when we had to do numerical things, because of this, these equivalence constraints, we've reduced our search space, that it was fairly easy to sample a large number of parameters to do things like those time courses to show that one design is always faster than another. So those are some features of these kinds of problems which I think lead to their success. In the case of the last one I showed you, it's, you know, monofunctional, bifunctional sensors. If you've got something which is a spectrum of dozens of different things or a continuum of things, it's going to be very hard to do all those pairwise comparisons, and it would be less fruitful. And I think that's about the time, so I probably won't have ability to go back and do that second example. Anybody who's interested, I'd certainly be willing to hang around very much. But I'll stop there.